This is XTP Media.
I feel the need
for speed.
Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 39 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me today are my co-presenters, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very good. Hello, everybody.
And, of course, Editor at Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer. Gareth, how are you today?
I'm ridiculously excited. Hello, Peter. Hello, everybody.
And of course, Gareth is excited because following Tim's epic X10 top 10 carrier aircraft listing back in episode, I think it was 36, we had a massive response to the number one aircraft, and that, of course, was the Grumman F-14 Tomcat. And we were contacted directly by John Spielberger, who runs the Facebook group I Want One of Those F-14 Tomcat. And as a result, I'm delighted to welcome former F-14 radar intercept officer and Top Gun instructor Dave Baranek. A 20-year US Navy career starting with assignments to the F-14 Tomcat squadrons and the elite Top Gun training program, Dave was later assigned to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the US 7th Fleet. Bio has also commanded an F-14 Tomcat fighter squadron. He's a published author of both aviation articles and a book, and is an accomplished aviation photographer. And of course, he was advisor and participant in the 1986 film Top Gun. Bio, welcome to Extended.
Hi, Peter. Thanks. And thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys today.
We're very excited about this. We also have Andy Mortimer, a Royal Air Force's child. His father served in the RAF as a fairy, otherwise known as an engineering technician or ground crew. During his youth, he spent many an hour watching the F-4 Phantom. At the age of 5, he saw a visiting Tomcat and he fell in love with it. Now the other administrator on the Facebook group with John. Andy, welcome to Extended.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you. Andy, before we go to bio and before we hear from John, the F-14 Tomcat, 5 years old, what effect did that have on you?
What's dawned on me more than anything, it was an aircraft that I hadn't seen before. So it was something new. And I asked my father what it was. So he told me it was a Tomcat. So I asked him, how do you know it's a Tomcat? He said, look, it's got two tails, silly. And since then, I went out of my way to try and get books and do research on it. I was lucky enough to sit in it and walk around it, play on it, basically. And that was the last time I actually saw one in UK airspace until 1990, when that one was passing through at International Airspace Fairford.
And, of course, as I mentioned there, you were the son of an RAF RAF personnel. You saw lots of aircraft. I know you had a chosen desire to go into the Air Force, but due to the government cutbacks, that didn't work out. You did, however, get to have a little flight in an F-4, I believe.
Yeah, just after my 16th birthday. And because the squadron was withdrawing from Germany, they were like giving flights out. But because I, the long connection my father had with the Phantom and the RAF, I was given the opportunity to have a flight.
But well, we have to ask, what was that like? Because the F-4 is probably one of those aircraft we'd also like to do a special on.
To be honest, it was awesome. It all happened very quickly, as you can imagine. Taking off and pulling straight back, I've done it in gliders and all sorts of things, but in a fast jet, nothing beats it. A really adrenaline rush. It took me about between two and six hours to calm down back to Earth after landing. I was all on cloud nine.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you know what model it was that you flew?
It was the F4M UK, which is the British version of the F4J, with RF modifications involving avionics and the radar and the engines. The RF Phantoms had spare engines. We did have a squadron of F4Js, but they were well after Mouse when they realised we didn't have enough in service.
Right, okay. Now, of course, the F-14 Tomcat, this special episode that we're recording now, took over from the F-4, from the Phantom. And unfortunately, due to time challenges, John couldn't join us right on this call now. But I got the opportunity to speak to John earlier and get a chat with him a little bit about the group, a bit about the Tomcat, and a bit about his interests. So let's hear what John had to say. John, welcome to Extended.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for getting up so early with the vagaries of the international time differences. I'm sitting later in my day here, and it's very early for you. So thanks very much for making the time to join us from the west coast of the USA. You made contacts with us after hearing the episode with Tim's X-10 Top 10, where the F-14 Tomcat was our number one in the carrier aircraft listings. But as well as running the I Want a Tomcat group on Facebook, you've had a long love for the aircraft, haven't you? It started in Long Island, where you were a youngster.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, like many men my age, I grew up with Top Gun. I was watching the F-14 tear up the sky over and over again. Actually, though, back when I was young, maybe 9, 10 years old, my favorite aircraft was the F-16 Fighting Falcon.
Yeah.
But then with continued Top Gun viewing and then seeing the F-14 live at air shows, I just fell in love with the Tomcat.
And you managed to see quite a few. I think they were built nearby where you lived, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They were designed and partially built, I should say, at the Bethpage, New York Grumman facility, which is about an hour's drive east of Manhattan.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I was 3 or 4 years old, and I wasn't really aware of what was going on down there. I was living literally just a few streets north of the plant and the airport there. But yeah, I wasn't old enough to appreciate it, really. But yeah.
We'll take those links wherever we can get them. She's a lovely lady, and sadly no longer in our skies. But where did the requirement for the F-14 come from?
It was designed as a replacement for the F-4 Phantom for the Navy in the late 1960s as a long-range, all-weather air superiority fighter and interceptor. But as a matter of fact, it was one of two swing wing fighters, the other being the F-111 Aardvark, being sought out by the Navy. The F-111 was ultimately deemed unfit for aircraft carrier operations due to weight and performance issues. It was nicknamed the Tomcat for Vice Admiral Thomas F. Connolly, who back in the late 60s, he was the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air Warfare, and he determined, or helped determine at least, that the F-111 was unfit for carrier ops, leading the way for the Tomcat to come aboard. And, of course, Grumman named a lot of their airplanes by cats. So back in World War II, you had the Hellcat, the Wildcat, and later you had the Tiger and Panther. So it just followed in that line there. And it was nicknamed the Turkey by air crews and carrier deck personnel for the way on approach to the carrier would constantly be adjusting its horizontal stabilizers and tailerons. And to them, to the landing signal officers, it just looked like a turkey.
Okay. I'd not heard that either. And so the F-14, the Tomcat as we know it, came out of that same design, did it? Or did it come from a brand new design?
it was a brand new design, as I understand it, because yeah. F-111 was General Dynamics, yeah. and the F-14 was by Grumman.
Of course, I think there was a tie up there somewhere, but obviously there are some similarities. You can see some of the design concept and the shape, of course, when she's got that beautiful swept wing. So tell us a little bit about the aircraft for some of our younger listeners. What was she like? What did she look like? And how was she powered?
Well, she was she's still around, a swing wing aircraft, two tails, large, powerful afterburning turbofan engines. It had some revolutionary systems on it, including advanced radar, capable of tracking 24 targets and firing on 6 of them simultaneously with long-range AIM 54 Phoenix missiles.
Yeah.
An earlier design featured a single tall tail, but hangar bay constraints on the carrier called for a shorter tail. So Grumman decided two smaller tails would more than make up for one.
I'm just picturing, as you're describing there, the aircraft. I think the great thing about it is it just feels very powerful, doesn't it? It always looked very powerful, very strong, and very able. But it was also quite nimble as a fighter.
Absolutely. Absolutely it was.
So, John, what makes the Tomcat so special for you?
Well, as we just touched upon, it's graceful and it's menacing. And, you know, it's the plane. It's from Top Gun. It's the Top Gun plane, as people know. And, you know, everyone's heard of one or has an idea of what it looks like. You know, it's got those twin tails. It's got the tandem cockpit seating under a bubble canopy. It's got massive intakes and loud afterburning engines. And, you know, I have a personal connection to it because it's from Long Island like me.
Yeah. So
how can you not like it?
That's a really good point, actually. How can you not like this aircraft? But one of the things that I got to say I was very jealous about when you mentioned it to me is you got to see Tomcats perform at Miramar.
Yes, I did. In fact, I was at the last Navy air show in 1997. It was unforgettable.
Yeah. What are your favorite memories then of the Tomcat?
Okay. Well, like I said, I saw it at the last Navy air show at Miramar, and it was the year before it was turned over to the Marines in 1998. And on that day, I think it was August of 97, it was a Tomcat tour de force. And first thing was at the climax of our national anthem, which is called the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah,
there was a transonic F-14 flyby, low altitude, right past the grandstands, right at the end of it. It was, I can't put it into words.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
So, John, we're just talking about its performance at air shows, but I do know you saw it many times at shows, and you've really got a strong view about how captivating it was.
It was absolutely captivating. I'll always remember that at all the shows I've been to, and I've been to numerous ones before the Tomcat was retired. I went to the first time I saw it live was at Marine Corps Air Station El Toro, which is here in Southern California, in 1997 before it was closed. And at the El Centro Naval Air Facility, which is east of San Diego, I saw that in the rain.
Wow.
And it was an all-weather fighter, so it performed in the rain. And then right after that, I think I should call it like a rain delay,
yeah.
as you would here in the States, a rain delay, but that's something I'll remember.
So the Tomcat flew through it.
Indeed. And people, you know, and I also saw it in Chicago at the Air and Water Show there, and it was phenomenal there as well. And what I'll always remember is how patrons at all the air shows, they would stop what they were doing. If they're in line for the bathroom or if they're in line for getting food or walking around the air show grounds, they would just stop whatever they're doing and stand and watch the Tomcat. It was literally a showstopper. And they were watching full afterburner takeoffs, rolling and swing wing maneuvers, as well as mock carrier approaches and transonic high-speed passes. It was awesome.
It's funny, the Tomcat really does bring up an emotional connection, doesn't it? I'm trying to put my finger on what it is about the Tomcat. Obviously, the film made a big difference. I think it brought it all into our lives. But it really just grabs you.
Yeah, it's power. Yeah. One word, it's just power.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Now, the F-14 was retired, I think, in 2006, 2007.
Yes, it was retired September 22nd, 2006 from the Navy.
Yeah. I was quite surprised that it spent 32 years in frontline service as well. I don't know why. I just thought it was less than that. But 32 years, that's a pretty good innings. But it's no longer operational in the U.S., but I believe there's some Tomcats still flying in Iran.
Yes, Iran is flying some Tomcats from a deal that the states had with Iran back in the early 70s. And this was while, you know, they were still friends before the 1979 revolution. So,
John, where did the Tomcats see active service then? It was obviously with the U.S. and Iran we talked there. But what engagements was it involved in?
It participated in various ones, including one against Libyan MiGs in 1981 in what's known as the Gulf of Sidra incident.
Yeah.
It's also flown in Desert Storm and more recently in Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan in 2001. And Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003.
Right.
It's basically, since its inception, had an air-to-air role. But in the mid-90s, it was fitted for bombing. And it was basically known as the Bombcat.
I've never heard that term, actually. What was its performance like then? Because she was a very fast bird for a day, wasn't she?
Indeed, indeed. Top speed was Mach 2.34, or about 1,500 miles an hour, with a range, depending on load and armament, of between 500 and 1,500 nautical miles, flying as high as 50,000 feet. It carries one 20-millimeter Gatling gun, as well as, we mentioned this before, the AIM-54 Phoenix missile, the AIM-7 Sparrow, and the AIM-9 Sidewinders. It's got a two-man crew. One is a pilot responsible for flying, sits in the front, and the other, a radar intercept officer, or RIO, specializing in weapons and sensors, sitting behind the pilot in the bubble canopy.
Okay, so where are some of the F-14 airframes now? You mentioned earlier it hasn't gone. Where are they now? There's none that are operational, I take it. There's none that are ground running?
As far as I know, there aren't. Unfortunately, many of the airframes have been scrapped due to Iranian security concerns, but at last check, there are about 75 available to view, including one on display at the Northrop Grumman plant in Bethpage, and one at what's called Grumman Memorial Park at Calverton, New York, which is about 45 minutes east of Bethpage on Long Island, and that's where the Tomcat was taken for final assembly. The airframes were trucked from Bethpage and assembled in the final product over there at Calverton, and they were test flown there. In fact, the first test flight was December 21st, 1970. But as far as other Tomcats, there's two at Pax River Naval Air Station.
Wonderful.
There's one at the USS. It's on the USS Intrepid Aircraft Carrier Museum, which is in Manhattan, docked on the west side.
Right.
There's one at the USS Midway Museum in San Diego in California. There's one at the Ronald Reagan Library west of L.A. here. There's one at the Air Museum in Chino, California, which is a short drive from where I live. And I went there a few months ago. It's spectacular.
Yeah.
And finally, there's one at the Air Zoo in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I went to school.
Okay, so you then set up the Facebook group as well. I want an F-14 Tomcat. That's a pretty interesting title. Tell us a little bit about the group.
Well, actually, I was not responsible for setting it up.
Oh, okay.
It was already in place, and it just had a handful of followers. And in 2006, I don't remember exactly when, but I started administrating the group when the previous administrator left. Andy Mortimer, who you'll be talking shortly, he was one of the members of the group, and we got to talking and formed a friendship over the aircraft. And he says back then there were only four followers, so I'll take his word on that. then in 2011, I added him as a co-administrator along with David Parsons, call sign Hey Joe,
yeah,
who was a Rio in the Tomcat, radar intercept officer, and another guy, a chap named Federico Carotti. And Federico, if you're listening, I apologize if I messed up your last name there, but and he's another Tomcat fan. We're in charge of approving members who request to join. We don't let just anybody join. You know, we need to be sure who we're adding. Like I said, we're in charge of approving members who request to join, making sure the members treat each other with respect, and only making posts germane to the scope of the group, which is basically the F-14, Naval Aviation, and Grumman Aircraft.
So, John, you've got some great subscribers. There's some great content on the group, particularly for those who love the good old Tomcat. What's your favourite? What sort of stories have you seen over those years? That's quite a long time for a group like that to be still running and operational. You must have seen some really great stuff.
Yeah, people are posting things all the time. I can't really pinpoint a specific story. But I do recall one recently, somebody posted something about Iran flying their Tomcats. And I made a comment that, like, Iran flying Tomcats is like seeing your hot ex-girlfriend, who you still have feelings for, shacking up with some other guy.
Yeah, I suppose it does feel like that. Wow. Okay. So what's the future of the group like? Do you keep on running it? Are you looking for new members? Are you looking for new content?
Well, we just expect to keep adding members and seeing where things go. I don't think we want to be the largest Facebook F-14 Facebook group, but more members is always a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many different kinds of groups about the F-14. Ours is general. It's a general fan page.
Yeah.
But there are others out there that focus on specific squadrons and other things like that. David Parsons, who I mentioned earlier, he co-admins our group, like I said, and one called Tomcat Territory.
We talked about Top Gun earlier, the film, and I think we're going to talk about that a little later as well. But that really had a big influence on you, didn't it? You went after a career in aviation. What do you do now?
Okay, well, right now I work for an airline here at Los Angeles International Airport. It's more commonly known as LAX. I've been here for about 3 years, where before my current capacity, I was an intern at the Airport Authority. I've always been into aviation from a young age by way of Top Gun, but also as many youngsters like me by watching planes at the airport. I spent a lot of my youth in South Florida, about an hour north of Miami. And I would occasionally go to the airport at Fort Lauderdale with my dad and take photos of planes landing and taking off. Then in the early 2000s, when I lived in Chicago, I graduated from Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, where the Air Zoo is located, I mentioned previously.
Yeah.
I was focusing on an aviation business degree. I did some flying. I flew Cessna 172s there, but ultimately decided a flight major was unfeasible.
Yeah.
Then a few years later, I applied to Navy Officer Candidate School for pilot. Had I gotten in and followed the pilot, quote-unquote, pipeline, as it's known, no matter what kind of aircraft I would have flown, be it fighter, cargo, bomber, the Tomcat had been retired for a few years, so I wouldn't have had the chance to fly it, unfortunately.
Okay. But you're still in and around aviation, and it's great to hear that you chose a career in the sector. And we do push that not everybody sits in the pointy end of the airplane. There's a lot of great careers around and about, and other roles to fulfill. So interesting you chose to take that route. John, let's come back to the group. Where can we find out a little bit more about the group online, and maybe you and some of the other guys?
Well, I want an F-14 Tomcat. It's on Facebook. Just search the name or search F-14 Tomcat and we should pop up. As for me, I'm on Facebook myself. Just search my name, John Spielberger, and it's spelled J-O-N, no H. Last name is spelled, it's like the director, Steven Spielberg.
Right.
S-P-I-E-L-B-E-R-G-E-R, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only one there with that name. So I have other social media accounts, but focus pretty much on Facebook. So folks can look me they can look for me there.
Right. Okay, then, John. John, thank you very much for getting up early to speak to us all the way across from Los Angeles, California. John, take care.
My pleasure.
Now, before anyone writes in, immediately I stopped recording with John earlier. He asked me to correct a comment he made about the first Gulf of Sidra incident, when in fact, of course, it was two Libyan Su-22 fitters that fired on the F-14 Tomcats and were subsequently shot down, and not MiGs, as he mentioned there. So apologies to anyone, but John immediately corrected that, knowing that he'd slipped up a little bit. But Bio, great guy, has done a lot of work to get that group going, hasn't he?
Oh, Peter, John really has done a lot of work. And I listened to his comments, and I thought he did a great job of covering the F-14 conversion to a strike fighter.
Yeah.
And the pilot and the Rio roles, too. So that was a nice setup for our discussion today.
Yeah, no, it was good. Great guy, really nice guy. So enjoyed speaking to him. And I know he was absolutely mortified that he wasn't here on this call, but he works shifts, he works in the industry, and he's doing a great job there as well.
I was going to sort of say, I think it's a testament, the popularity of the Tomcat that you know, where you've got this kind of active growing communities around a jet that's been retired, you know, and people still joining it, still interested in it, still want to know the history of it. It's kind of interesting, really, you know. And only a couple of weeks ago, there was a big announcement about an F-14 add-on F-14 for DCS World Flight Sim. You know, obviously, I'm you guys know, regulars know my interest in flight sims, but. That was announced for DCS World, and the thread in which it was announced could have been to about, I don't know, 50 or 60 pages in about 24 hours.
Wow.
It's an iconic aircraft.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, I sent a few tweets out. I know Gareth and Tim have picked a few up today as well, just to set the scene for the interview that we're having now. And they're just picked up straight away. It's such an iconic aircraft. So before we go for a break, Tim and Gareth, let's put you guys on the spot. Let's stick with you then first, Tim. Give Gareth a bit of time to have a think about this. putting you on the spot. What is it that the F-14 Tomcat does for you then? Why is it so special?
Okay, obviously there's the movie connection, but I think you know, it just looks like a fighter, doesn't it? You know, it looks like if you were a small kid in the 80s and you were drawing kind of shapes in a drawing shapes and jet shapes in a school book, your school exercise book, you'd probably come out something looking like that. And it looks good from every angle.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like it's going fast, even on the ground. Even with the gear down, flaps down in the circuit, you know, looks brilliant. I think that's it.
Yeah, I agree. And as John said earlier, it's just that power, isn't it? It's just that power. What about you, Gareth? What made the Tomcat so special for you?
You can't ignore. For a certain generation, you can't ignore the movie connection. But obviously, yeah, there's a lot more to, yeah, the film. The aircraft is not defined by the film. The film just put the aircraft in front of a global audience. But yeah, I agree with all those points. You know, she was big. She had swing wing. She had twin tails. She had two engines. She was noisy. She had Phoenix missiles that could fire, you know, shoot things down from, you know, massive distances away, you know, distances that as a child you could barely comprehend. And and also I think the carrier part of it was important as well. Just added to the whole sort of mystique of the aircraft. And I have to say, from the probably only two occasions that I saw it in the flesh, one of which would have been at Mildenhall, she was a spectacular air show performer as well. And that's something that as a child, I think, always leaves an impression.
Yeah, that's where I saw the aircraft at Mildenhall as well. So absolutely delighted I got to see her. And for me, again, it was that power. It was the noise. And the capability. It's a big aircraft, but it was pretty nimble around the skies.
I think most of us, especially over in the UK, really wished that Duxford accepted the Tomcat when they offered one. really do. Because I think that would have been good in the American Museum and there.
Yeah. That's amazing. They were offered one and rejected it, huh?
No, yeah. They've got an American History Museum there. And it's all warbirds mainly. But the reason they turned it down was because they didn't have the space and the money to be able to convert it to static condition. Even though the Americans were going to take one off their carry on the way past and land it. And they turned it down.
Oh, gosh.
I could have found a home for it.
I would have a home for it as well. I know somebody who would have paid the 20 join grand the, to do a hard standing.
Join the queue, Robinson.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm first.
Anyway, okay, we're going to take a very quick break now. And after that, we're going to come back and talk to Bio.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Tower, this is Ghost Rider requesting a flyby.
Negative, Ghost Rider, the pattern is full.
No, ma'am, this is not a good idea. Sorry, Goose, but it's time to buzz the tower.
So we're back with Bio, of course, Rio in the F-14 Tomcat and a very distinguished U.S. Navy career. But Bio, where did this all start?
You know, I wish I could put my finger on a single specific event, but for me, it was just a culmination of things. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, which and my dad used to take us to air shows all the time. We went to every air show. And so I guess from that, by the time I was around 10 years old, 11 years old, I really knew I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And for me, I wanted to fly F-8 Crusaders. That was my choice.
Right. Okay.
And because it was in the late 60s. I knew the Phantom was the hot new jet, but I liked the Crusader. And so my dreams were dashed for two reasons. When I went to college I started college in 1975. The F-8 was nearly retired by then, and my eyesight went bad, so I couldn't be a fighter pilot. But the F-14 was brand new. I decided to try to become a Rio, and so that's what I set my sights on. That was my goal, becoming an F-14 Rio.
And Bio, what did you do in terms of your initial training? Did you go into the Navy in a specific role, or did you go straight in to go into a flight role?
In ROTC, I took ROTC in college, and then near graduation, we had to request what community we wanted to go to, and so I requested aviation. Got selected and went down to Pensacola. And I actually, thinking back on that, I mean, you have to compete and earn every step along the way. And so, you know, even though it was my dream to fly and to be an F-14 Rio, that you still have to compete and earn it. And so I did.
Right. Okay. And what were the sorts of challenges during those early days of training?
Oh, that's an easy question. The first challenge was on my first training flight. I get airsick.
Oh God.
And so I'm thinking, well, this is a terrible way to start for a guy who wants to fly fighters.
Yeah.
But luckily, and the instructors are very understanding. They said, you know, a certain percentage of people do get airsick, especially in their first flight. And in my case, I was able to work through it. And so after a few flights, I got more comfortable and eventually I stopped getting airsick. That was the first thing. Other things were just the standard challenges. And that is there's a lot of material to assimilate. It's a whole new way of thinking, et cetera. I had no aviation experience at all. I mean, I'd taken a 30-minute orientation flight for $10 You could pay $10 back in 1975 and get a 30-minute orientation flight. And so I did that in my hometown.
Okay. And what aircraft were you training on in those early days? What are the aircraft they were using for aircrew training?
Peter, I got to tell you, and it's kind of early to start pimping products, but my publisher just accepted my second book, which goes over this stuff. So I'm happy to talk about it because I just refreshed all this. But I started, my first flight was in the T2 Buckeye, and then we did about probably, I don't know, 20 flights in that, and then we switched to the T-39 Sabreliner. Yep. for Rio training. And then we, at the end of VT-86, which was the second training squadron, we got six flights in the TA-4 Skyhawk.
Right.
So those are some old jets, and I believe, and they're all retired now from U.S. service.
But still great jets for some of us who are slightly ill of age, able to remember, but great jets. So tell us a little bit about the Rio training then and leading up to your Tomcat assignment.
Well, the first thing that they made us do was they need you to function as an air crew. And even though Navy pilots are capable of operating that airplane by themselves, they could certainly aviate, navigate, and communicate. They had to teach us to do that because we were going to be an important part of the air crew. So they taught us about air-to-air navigation. They taught us about talking to air traffic control agencies. They taught us about weather briefings. We had to learn the pre-flight because you are an accountable and participating member of that air crew. I mean, that's what you're going to be. And so they start to hold you accountable starting on your first flight. I mean, they expect you to catch things. If the pilot, for example, does not perform the landing checklist before you come into land, it's the student NFO is supposed to make sure that he does it. And so they teach you all that stuff. So you're not a passenger getting a free ride. You're an accountable member of the crew.
Not to jump too far ahead here, but one point that did jump out on me when I was looking at the spec of the aircraft and the role of the Rio is you had control over the ejection seats for carrier takeoffs.
Now, that's a selectable switch. In the F-14, there was a switch in the back seat, and you could move it to the forward position. And if it was in the forward position, then the Rio would eject only himself.
Right. Okay. But you had that control, did you?
The switch was in the back seat. But wow. You know, if you're flying an orientation flight, then they'll move that switch to the forward position. And in fact, that's the case that saved the airplane in that famous picture of the convertible F-14. It's a VF-213 jet. Where a person in the back seat was on an orientation flight. He inadvertently ejected himself. He survived, and the pilot stayed in the plane and brought the plane back.
Wow. Good crew resource management, as they say, to have the trust in in the two crew members to have control over that switch.
Well, and in my case, in my ejection, which happened just 6 months after I joined my fleet squadron, that was one of the reasons that we were able to both survive is that we had to switch in the Rio position. I pulled the handle, and my pilot and I both got out. Of course, he was busy trying to fly the jet, hold it level as we went over the side on the carrier flight deck. And we can talk about that episode later.
Yeah. Gosh. Okay. Well, let's talk about the role of the Rio then, and let's talk about the Tomcat. How was your familiarization to the aircraft? What did you have to go to qualify as a Rio on the Tomcat?
I went through it's called the RAG, which stood for Replacement Air Group or Readiness Air Group. And that was that's an archaic term, but it's so easy to say that it stuck. By the time I went, the official name was, I believe, FRS, Fleet Replacement Squadron, something like that. I went through that, and in my case, it lasted about 9 months. This was in 1980, 81, and it involved getting about 100 hours of flight time. So however many flights that was, you know, probably around 60 flights, something like that. And it's similar to Pensacola. They start you with basic aircraft familiarization training so you can operate. Now, and some of the, you know, the normal progression was classroom session, simulator session, and then the flight, classroom, right, simulator flight. And so, you know, you learn about the weapon system, then you learn about the mission. And so we flew long-range intercept missions. We flew ACM, air combat maneuvering, which was close-in dogfighting and stuff like that. And so I got 100 hours. And once I completed the reg, I was combat ready.
Right.
But what that really means is you report to your squadron and you're ready. Okay, now you're ready to learn a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. So where does bio come from? Where does your call sign come from?
When I was finishing the reg, they asked us, what do you want your call sign to be?
I thought they assigned it to you. I didn't know you had the choice of...
Well, I mean, it's different in different organizations and over time, but I mean, they asked us, and I thought it was a goofy question because most guys, you know, came up with something, and you know, everybody wants to be killer and tiger and shark and whatever, and it doesn't matter. But they asked us, and in my case though, I said, okay, Dave Baronic. Baronic rhymes with bionic, and over here in the States, you know, we had just had the TV show, The Bionic Man and The Bionic Woman and stuff. And so I said, I want to be bionic. Well, I got to VF-24, my first squadron, and the pilot I was flying with said, you know, I'm not going to call you bionic, because I was tall and skinny and ensign. And so he shortened it to bio, and that stuck. And I said, okay, that's good. I'm happy with that.
Right. Okay. All right.
And then in case of other guys, some guys tried to give themselves call signs that were just a little bit too cool. And, you know, they'd get stuck with various humorous or obscene or whatever call signs.
Right. Okay. And what rank were you at this point, Bio?
I was an ensign when I got to VF-24.
Right, okay.
Which is an O-1, and then a few months later, I became a Lieutenant JG, which was, you know, 99% of ensigns get promoted to JG, so that really wasn't much of an accomplishment.
Turn up with the numbers, as it were.
Yeah.
Okay, so coming out of the training academy, you've been assigned to your squadron and you've done your familiarization with the aircraft. Let's talk about the Tomcat then. F-14As you were flying then, yeah?
I was flying F-14As. And you know what? This reminds me of something. When Andy was talking about his ride in an F-4, and first off, he was incredibly fortunate to get that familiarization flight up in the F-4. Yeah. But he said it was over so fast, and it reminds me of some of my early experiences. Now, my first flight in the F-14, I felt well prepared for it because of the simulators I'd had. And so I was able to assimilate and understand a lot of things. But in my first carrier landings in the F-14, I mean, it was a blur. I hate to say it. It was a blur.
Is that because there was so much going on, or yes, it happened so fast, or combination? Yes.
And I had been both of a combination. And I had been through training, a lot of field carrier landing practice, et cetera. But that environment was so fast. And then I'm going to contrast that to a couple of months later, I'm in my fleet squadron, where, like you said, I'm graduated from the training squadron. I'm in my fleet squadron. And now I'm doing carrier landings twice a day, day after day. And your brain really gets up to speed very quickly.
Yeah.
And so I'm able to understand and contribute to what's going on.
So tell us the role of the Rio in the takeoffs and the landings on the F-14. What were the activities that you were required to undertake?
Okay, the first one is very basic, and that is, I call it co-pilot duties. And that goes back to what you already mentioned, cockpit resource management or crew resource management. In the F-14, again, I'm giving full credit to Navy pilots. I mean, look at the F-18 Hornet and, of course, the F-15, F-16, single seat in most versions. You know, the pilot can operate the plane. But yeah, So let's get that out of the way. You know, that's the way I feel. Pilot can operate the plane. But in the F-14, the Rio is there, and so he was assigned duties. One was the Rio was by assignment, was assigned for communication. So I, you know, I called the tower for takeoff. You know, I put the clearance on request, stuff like that. Not a big deal, but that was part of my job. Then I did co-pilot duties. I was responsible for initiating the takeoff checklist and all these other things. I was also responsible for navigation.
Yeah.
You know, the pilot expected me and relied on me to plan the route and to keep us on the route when we were airborne. Now, if I screwed up and the pilot goes, "Hey, bio, what are we doing over here?" Well, that shows that I screwed up, and it's a good thing I had a good pilot. And as a matter of professional pride, I didn't want to make those mistakes.
And bio, just sorry interrupting you there. Yeah. What sort of navigation support did you have in the aircraft?
Okay. You know, for everybody in the world now has a GPS in their car.
Yeah.
Okay, so everybody – but you got to go back to 1980, 81. GPS was just a dream. And we had an inertial navigation system. And the problem with that was in the F-14, sometimes it was very good and sometimes it wasn't. And in some cases, you could tell when it wasn't good. I mean, but this was the best that the Navy could procure at the time, the best they could afford and the best available, whatever. And so if it was good, then it would give you, you know, point-to-point distance from where you were to any place you wanted to go, give you heading, you know, time to go and all that. But if it was bad, then you better be ready to back it up or you're going to get in trouble. And in fact, there was one case of an F-14 that was lost, at least one case that I know of, F-14 that was lost because the crew did not perform a good backup, and they were following their inertial nav system, and then they – out in the middle of the ocean, didn't know where they were, and they ran out of fuel. Luckily, the crew were rescued after 24 hours.
Wow. Okay.
That really happened.
Yeah. Don't want to be out there. That's one of the challenges, of course, of being a Navy pilot as well. That's a pretty small airfield to find in a very large sea.
Oh, and Peter and the other guys, let me tell you. It is a horrible feeling when you're doing an exercise, and it's an emissions control exercise. So the carrier has its tachyon turned off and you've got your radar turned off. When you are out there looking for that aircraft carrier visually and it's supposed to be somewhere and you don't see it, and then you start going, "Oh gosh," you don't say, "Oh gosh."
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's also something that it's an airfield that moves as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they told you, "Okay, we'll be at this location when your recovery time," you're sitting there and you go, "Well, clearly they went where they wanted to, and the fact that they told you this location, they didn't really feel bound by that, you know. That was just it never happened to me. But on the other hand, it's like running out of fuel and various other things. It happened to a few people every year. And so it's not something that is unthinkable.
Yeah.
You got to remember, these bad things happened all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So let me get back to my role and my mission. The cool part of my role, the RIO's role, was when you get on the mission, when you detect targets, and it's up to the RIO to operate the weapon system, to paint the picture, and if you're in a tactical environment, to give direction to the pilot or to the section or the division, that's the two airplanes or the four airplanes, for the RIO to take charge and get everything started so you can complete your mission, whatever it's assigned, to intercept these guys, to shoot them down or whatever.
Yeah. And what was your role when you first went into the fleet? Was it air defense?
Oh yeah. And that's the F-14 was almost purely air to air. At that time, the only air to ground mission that we would have had was strafing with our gun. And we did practice that. We practiced that, although we were sitting there, you know, wondering, you know, very unlikely we would do it, but we practiced strafing ground targets. So we are strictly air to air. And in fact, my first squadron, VF-24, was not a TARPS squadron. When the Vigilante was retired and the RF-8s, the F-14 got the TARPS pod and picked up the reconnaissance mission.
Yeah.
But that was only the one out of the squadrons on the carrier.
So right, okay.
We're strictly at air, yes.
What was the armament that you were carrying? What would be a regular mission
always,
load?
When we were in the United States, we rarely carried live weapons for training flights. We carried simulators. But once the aircraft carrier left on deployment, we always carried live weapons. And, okay, let's start with the little ones. We always had a full round of ammunition for the gun, so more than 600 rounds. We almost every flight we carried at least one Sidewinder because, you know, it weighs so little, and you could always carry one. We usually carried two. These were AIM-9. At right. first, they were AIM-9 Golf Hotels, and then pretty soon they introduced the AIM-9 Lima.
Right, okay.
Then we usually carried at least one AIM-7 Sparrow. And again, when I first started, we were mostly carrying AIM-7 Foxtrots. We used the AIM-7 Echoes for missile shoots. We carried AIM-7 Foxtrots, and then pretty soon they introduced the AIM-7 Mike. And then we often carried the Phoenix, but I got to tell you, many times, I would say even on deployment, we probably carried it 50%. We carry one Phoenix or more.
Because that seems to – that it was the aircraft was just so well known for the Phoenix. And you know, we all look at it and think, oh, my God, it could carry six, normally carried four. But obviously it
didn't. Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why. Because one of our main concerns was fuel. And when you carried the Phoenix, it reduced your bring-back fuel by 1,000 pounds. And so we wanted to have the most looks at the deck. So you come back with a maximum, we called it max trap, M-A-X-T-R-A-P. That was the maximum weight of fuel you could have to land because the F-14 had a landing gross weight limit. Okay?
Yeah.
So everything's – and these are the kind of things that if you're not an aviation professional and you've never thought about this – then once you get into the business and you start learning all this stuff, it really makes it a rewarding, challenging, fulfilling job and mission. So, I mean, you know, it would be like eating whipped cream all the time. Yeah, a spoonful of whipped cream tastes good, but if there's no substance, you know. So, yes, it's fun flying around the sky in a jet, but if there's got to be some, you know, some content, something to challenge.
Yeah.
And so all these mission planning things, they made it a very rich experience. So we didn't carry the Phoenix because it cut down on the amount of fuel that we could bring back to the carrier.
Bio, can I ask a technical question on the Phoenix? I mean, obviously it's a retired weapon now. So what kind of confidence did you have in the weapon? It's pretty lethal on paper.
Yeah,
but up against sort of Soviet bombers with jamming support, et cetera, was it as good as you know, kind of people, you know, think it was?
Well, it was probably better than some people think it was because I know people that, you know, dismiss it. And it's important to remember that there were two Phoenixes, one, the AIM-54 Alpha, the one they made first. That had a couple of limitations, but still it did some pretty good demonstrations against maneuvering targets, and it had some, you know, it had good anti-electronic warfare capabilities. That was the A model.
Yep.
So we were pretty comfortable. We were very confident with it. Then in the about 1987, 88, they introduced the Charlie AIM-54C. That was a great missile. It had a lot. I mean, when I started reading about it, I thought this thing is tenacious because it had great degrade capabilities. You know, if it loses communication with their launch and airplane and all these other situations, it is still going to try hard to get to the target. So I like the Phoenix.
Bio, can I just chip in with a quick question? If you're going to carry a missile around that's got a range of over 100 nautical miles, you've got to have a pretty damn good radar on your aircraft in the first place to match up to match up with it. I just wanted to ask, how big a sort of leap forward was the radar that you had on the Tomcat from what you'd been operating before in say the F4?
Well, see, I had very little F4 time. I mean, my only F4 time was that when I became a Top Gun instructor, I got some joyrides in the F4. But when the F-14 was new, its radar was, you know, just the best in the world. I mean, it was incredible. And the one of its biggest limitations was it didn't have so-called medium PRF processing, which was Aug-9 never got that. And so it did have some, you know, it had some problems, but those were in certain environments. There were ways to work through it. Okay. And so in terms of range, power, number of targets and all that, I mean, it was an incredible leap forward when it first came out.
Okay.
Bio, so the question really, I suppose we all want to ask is, did you fire any live weapons?
I never fired in combat in terms of... In terms of training, yes, I did. In fact, I fired Sidewinders, which is a pilot missile. I was on a Sidewinder missile shoot shortly after I got to the squadron. That was my first missile shoot. Then I went on several AIM-7 Sparrow shoots in VF-24, including one that we had to go supersonic, and the target was going supersonic. And they told us to shoot at the edge of the envelope because they were trying to verify the missile performance. And so that was a lot of fun.
Wow.
And then eventually my second F-14 squadron, VF-2, I got to shoot a Phoenix. But it was a short range shot, but that was still pretty cool because it was against a jamming target at low altitude.
When the missile leaves the aircraft, what's that feel like? Do you feel it detach and shoot off? What's the feeling? What's the sensation?
The Sidewinder, it only weighs 200 pounds, and it's carried on the F-14. It's carried on the wing pylons. They were mounted on the glove vanes, and so it comes off with and you really don't feel it. I mean, maybe it shakes the plane a little bit, or you know, the AIM-7 Sparrow, if it's launched from the belly, weighs 500 pounds, and it's got explosive charges that blow it off the airplane to ensure separation. And so you feel the recoil of those in your feet.
Yeah.
So when you launch the Sparrow and then the Phoenix, same thing, except it weighs 1,000 pounds. The Phoenix and the Sparrow, when those are launched from the belly station, it's like something is banging your feet. Wow. Because it is like something just thumped the airplane. It's like boom. And then it comes off. Okay. And then the next thing is the AIM-7 and also the AIM-54 Phoenix, 500 pounds, 1,000 pounds. They have powerful rockets and they are off like a shot. I mean, they come off and it's like, it's impressive. Oh, it's cool.
So before we talk some of your career stories and some of the incidents, let's just stick with the cockpit of the F-14. I've got a little graphic in front of me that we shared, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, or we'll put this up in the show notes. We've had some listeners who wanted to have, I suppose, a walkthrough what was in your cockpit, what the instruments were and what you were responsible for. Could you give us a run round, say clockwise run round of
sure.
What the cockpit is?
Okay. Let's start with what you cannot see. And that's off the picture on the left. So under your left arm, left hand, the first thing that was there in the F-14A was called a computer address panel. It was a rotary knob, and it had, I think, 6 or 8 pages of computer programs. And then what you do is you rotate the knob, push the button to do what you wanted. Later, they added the Lantern hand controller there. And so that's the Lantern air-to-ground targeting system. And it was like a control stick that popped up out of the panel. You use it with your left hand. And when I got exposed to that, I was a commander. I had about 2,000 hours or night, whatever, and I learned it very quickly. So it was well designed. Okay, then looking at most pictures, you see the armament control panel on the lower left of the picture. That's got knobs and switches, and most of those were set up for to jettison weapons. So that's an emergency situation that you would rarely use in normal operations. Here's the exception. You can see a little red button there with red and white stripes around it. That was how the Rio launched the Sparrow or the Phoenix. And, of course, that's something that had to be closely coordinated with the pilot to make sure that you only launch one missile when you wanted to launch one. So that was the Rio's launch button. Above that, you see the airspeed, altitude, artificial horizon. So basic flight instruments.
Yeah.
Then front and center at the top, you've got the radar controls, radar adjustment. On the left side, you've got electronic countermeasures adjustments and also radar, just radar tuning like gain and various other things that fine-tune the raw radar picture. Then you have the square scope, which is the detailed data display, DDD, which is basically raw radar. When we started flying, they told us it's not exactly raw radar. It's synthesized, but it looks like raw radar. So a fine point. At the top, of course, it's, yeah, I know. You get a lot. You know, there's a lot of technical fine points. It's like, okay, yeah. Fine. You're brilliant. Okay, got it. At the very top is the range buttons. And I think they went 1, 5, 10, 20, anyway, up to, yeah. I think we had, yeah, a lot of range. To the right of that was radar mode buttons. Track while scan, range while search, pulse Doppler search, and a lot of good radar controls. And I'm getting to the punchline of this. You guys are probably going, I know, get to the punchline. Okay, just below to the right of that is some navigation instruments and the fuel totalizer, which told you total fuel in the airplane. The yellow handle there is canopy jettison. In front of the Rio's right knee is the caution and advisory lights. The big round scope in the middle is the TID, tactical information display. That was pure synthesized symbology.
Right.
And you could use that as either a view of the front of the plane, you know, with the plane at the bottom, or yeah. You could change the display so the plane's in the center and north is at the top. And then on the right panel was electronic countermeasures and things like that. And guys, let me tell you, if you think this looks intimidating, spend, you know, a couple of months in the class and in the simulators, a couple of weeks in flying, and pretty soon you are using these things, using these buttons, changing controls without even thinking about it. I mean, it's subconscious.
Yeah, we'll take your word for it.
Okay, so that's the walk around.
It's quite high, isn't it? What was the visibility out like from your position?
Visibility was great. The visibility was great unless I was looking for an A4 I was engaged with and I couldn't see him. Then it's like, oh, geez, man. Yeah, visibility was very good. And as I recall, the F-14 was the first U.S. fighter in decades that had 360-degree view of the horizon. I mean, I could see, if I twisted around, I could see the horizon behind me. And I, looking over the pilot's shoulder, I could see most of the front. And similarly, the pilot could see, you know, all the way in the back, too. So we had very good visibility.
So, Bio, tell us a little bit about the ditching incident.
Okay, I'm going to correct a technical point. Okay. Okay, yeah, right. I've got it. Ditching is when you sit in the plane and hit the water. What we did was ejected. You know,
right.
Okay. And there's these things have like bailing out, for example, is if you just open the canopy and step out of the plane yourself. In our case, I was flying with Commander Bill Switzer, Squadron CO. We'd been out flying. It was a nice afternoon flight in the middle of the Indian Ocean. We'd been on deployment about 2.5 months, I guess. We're in the middle of the Indian Ocean. We're fighting some A7s. And it was a great flight. We came back to the carrier, and just based on the way the timing was and the fact that Commander Switzer was the senior guy in our flight, we were the first ones to land on that recovery. We come in, we're at the 90 degrees to go position behind the carrier. It's my 80th carrier landing. I've been in the squadron about 6 months, so I'm feeling pretty comfortable. And I'm thinking, oh, it's like 5:15 in the afternoon. I go, I can't wait to land. I'm going to get a cheeseburger for dinner tonight. I mean, it was as normal as could be. We land, we catch the cable, and it catches us. And then the next thing I know is I'm sitting straight up in my seat, which is not normal. And so, because normally when the cable catches you, you're thrown against the straps until you come to a complete stop. Well, I was thrown against the straps and then I'm sitting straight up. So we're rolling down the flight deck. It's silent. We've got about 1 second and my brain instantly went into overspeed thinking of a million thoughts, you know. The problem is I couldn't move super fast and I didn't have all the answers. I was just thinking of all kinds of thoughts, but I figured that a wire broke. And we had 1 second. The skipper goes, eject, eject. Well, my hand was on the lower handle, but I was sitting there going, man, if I pull this handle, there's no turning back, and we really have to do this, blah, blah, blah. When he said eject, though, I was spring-loaded. I pulled the ejection handle, and our seats fired. Now, this video is on my website, www.topgunbio.com. The video of the ejection is on my website, and you can see the plane gets to the end of the angle and then just drops like a stone. I mean, it got to the end going about 50 miles an hour, roughly. It didn't fade or, you know, glide a little. It came off the end and dropped. And our seats came out while it was falling from the flight deck to the water, which it's about a 60-foot fall, you know, acceleration due to gravity and everything that, you know, took whatever. It was a very close thing.
You pulled the handle. Obviously, everything then happens very, very quickly.
Everything happens quickly and automatically.
Yeah.
The seat knew that we were at low altitude. So as soon as the canopy was clear, the seat fired immediately. And then it knew we were at low altitude. And so it cut me out of the seat, opened my parachute, and it blew the parachute open. And so I did. I went up in the air I went to a height of just about 15 feet above the flight deck, and then I came straight down, and luckily I was over the water because I splashed into the water. My parachute opened just before I hit the water, and I splashed into the water. It was daytime. The water was warm. I was right next to the carrier, so I was feeling
good. But that's a big ship to be floating that very close to, isn't it?
Oh, it's time to talk aviation.
Wait a minute. Here's the other cool thing. Floating on the water next to me was Renegade 205, our jet. It was floating.
Oh my God.
I'm sitting there looking at this thing, and the tails look so big, and the carrier's
Email
going
us
by,
now.
And I'm going
Get
like,
Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk.
You know, really,
and remember,
that was
there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation
alive.
Questions,
yeah,
suggested
yeah.
topics,
now,
or even
good
old
Peter,
feedback
good
are all welcome.
I had not sat there and worried and gone, oh, I hope this goes okay. I mean, everything happened so fast that I was just in the reaction mode, and this was the first time I had the chance to make a value judgment, you know, to go, holy mackerel, what just happened? Oh, wow, and I'm alive, you know, so everything looked really cool.
Wow, okay.
Okay. The carrier, I was about 100 feet from the carrier because the jet was between me and the carrier. I mean, I don't know how all this worked out. I remember what I saw, but
yeah.
Everybody ran over to the edge of the flight deck, and I could see them. You know, I could see them. In my mind, and sitting here in my house, in my room, I'm looking up at about a 45-degree angle, and I can see the guys clear as day in my mind. I can see everybody on the edge of the flight deck. I give them a big thumbs up. The helicopter gets my attention because he's over my head. I look up, and I can see the crewman hanging out of the helicopter. And I give him a big thumbs up. And so they say, okay, he's doing okay. So they fly over to check Commander Switzer, the pilot. Well, he's behind me. And he is looking over at me, and he can see that I'm messing with my parachute. And so he sends a helicopter back over to me. And that was a good thing, because as soon as they left, I'm sitting there trying to get out of my parachute, and I realized I'm tangled up in my parachute. And so I had to get out my knife and cut myself out of it. And so I did. I popped up my switchblade, cut myself out, and the helicopter came over and lowered the harness and pulled me up.
Wow.
Now, again, it's not a plug for my book, but just given the time, in the book, which is called Top Gun Days, we haven't even mentioned that yet, I have the time to put things in perspective and give a few little explanations about how fortunate I was the way this worked out.
Right. Well, we're definitely going to put some links to the book in our show notes so that people can get access to that.
Just to wrap it up, I mean, it sounds like, oh, yeah, Bio, you jumped out, blah, blah, blah. But the helicopter crew, they did not lower a swimmer because they saw that I was tangled up in my parachute, and they saw the parachute was starting to get pulled by the ship's wake. Which would have sent it swirling in the water and stuff and would have dragged me with it. And so they realized, I mean, they did an incredible job. The pilot, the helicopter pilot, was Commander Sam Taylor. And in my book, I mention all four guys that were in the crew because, you know, they saved me by their quick thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the cause of the aircraft failing like that?
It was a couple of things. So the most basic cause was that the guy who was responsible for adjusting the arresting gear engines, he was a trainee, and his supervisor wasn't watching him closely enough. And so the arresting gear, an F-14 weighed 51,800 pounds, and so the arresting gear, the fluids, the valves, everything was supposed to be set for 51,800 pounds. But it was, as I recall, it was just set for 14,000 pounds, which was like the lowest weight. And so we landed, we caught it. We caught that 14,000 pounds that slowed us down. And then all the machinery just broke. And the next thing that slowed us down a little bit was the, 1 7/8 inch steel cable. That breaking. So those things jerked us and slowed us down some, but they did not bring us to a stop. And the video that's on my website, and you can see it, and it's like the plane just goes over the side. It's just sad.
I haven't seen that. I must say, I went to the website. I didn't see that. I don't know why, but I'm definitely going to have a look. I tell you what, Bio, let's just take a little break there, and we'll come back and talk then about fighter training and Top Gun.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Okay, so after surviving that near-death experience not ditching from a carrier, ejecting, but you then went to the prestigious U.S. Navy Fighter Weapons School, Top Gun. How did that come about?
Well, it's just like in the movie. We got out of the helicopter in the Indian Ocean, climbed into our F-14, and flew back to Miramar. So, I'm glad you guys laughed. Cause I was kidding. What happened was, we completed the deployment. When we got back, I was selected to go to Top Gun as a student, and I went through with a very talented young pilot, Jaws, and. We worked well together, and we did 5 weeks of flying in the Top Gun class. And now the Top Gun class, I believe, is 9.5 weeks. So when we went through, it was strictly air to air. And as you can imagine, I mean, in 1982, the threat was not as capable as it is now. And so, you know, 5 weeks was enough. We did a lot of great flying and training. And as a result, largely as a result of our performance there, Jaws and I were both invited back and went back as instructors. And the way the Navy sends people to Top Gun and picks instructors now has changed. But back then it was pretty straightforward. And I go over this in the book. You know, we did well in the class. We had good reputations in the community. And so we went back as instructors. So I went back as an Top Gun instructor after about 3.5 years in the fleet in the F-14 squadron. So I showed up as an instructor in 1984 as a Navy lieutenant. I had 1,200 F-14 hours and I was ready to go.
One of the most fascinating things I think in your book is not just the flying, but the amount of preparation and effort that goes into the lectures or your presentation. So you're required to give, you know, it's almost like a master's degree or an exam, you know, like including little things like not wearing medal ribbons so the audience doesn't get distracted. What makes a Top Gun lecture or a briefing kind of different from, say, you know, an intelligence officer giving a you know, a squadron briefing to, you know,
That's a good question. Okay, so this is Tim, right?
Yep.
Okay, Tim, just wanted to make sure. So, okay, Tim, let me tell you what makes it different. One, the guy who's given the lecture is either a pilot or a RIO. So he's a guy who has probably done what he's talking about, or if he has not actually done it, he would do it. So, you know, that gives you a certain level of buy-in, of credibility, of commitment. And I've seen some very good intelligence briefings, but if a person is talking about something, second person, then that's different. The Top Gun instructors are pilots or RIOs for the most part. Occasionally, we did have our intelligence officer give briefings. Second is, I thought about this when I was writing the book. Top Gun instructors have established for themselves a very high standard. And I was amazed at this when I thought about it years later. I mean, the first instructors were Vietnam combat veterans. And they could have been, you know, they could have said, it's the guy who tells the best story or the guy who has the most kills or the most hours or something. But they didn't just do that. You have to have performance. You have to have credibility, yes. But they insist that when you give a lecture, you adhere to these high standards, like writing neatly on the board. And the reason for a lot of that is for standardization, so you don't distract the students. So the students, you know, they don't start comparing instructors. It's like they're getting a standard product, and they can focus on the content. And then the third thing is you've got to be subject matter expert doesn't seem adequate to describe what a Top Gun instructor is on his subject. I mean, he has been through an incredible amount of training from his other instructors who give him the murder board process, but also this studying the material available to him and stuff like that. So there's really a lot of preparation is done before a Top Gun instructor gives a lecture. And as I've said before, Air Force Fighter Weapons School, I never went to classes there, but we had an Air Force exchange officer and we work with those guys. And their standards are similar, if not even higher. And so I know there are units like this or other units around the world, but that's just a short summary of what it takes to earn this reputation. You've got to put in the effort. You've got to earn it.
And when you're – How long does the course last? It was five weeks, wasn't it?
When I was there as a student, it was 5 weeks, and when I was there as an instructor, it still stayed 5 weeks. And that was we had 8 fighters going through the class. Whether they were, it didn't matter if they were F-4s, F-14s, or F-18s. We had all 3 going through when I was there. 5 weeks.
And could you really sort of see the kind of progression, I suppose, in the students in from the start,
yes,
where they would get shot down every mission to the end where they could take you guys on?
Yes. Yeah, most definitely. And In fact, I mean, now every once in a while you get somebody who's like, God, this person just doesn't belong here. And in our day, in my day, we did not send anyone home, but I've talked to more recent instructors, and they do send people home who just don't make the cut. And that's the kind of, you know, improvement. That's a good thing. Everybody, you know, you have to meet the standards before you get the patch. But we would sit there, and I would sit there as an instructor, and you know, halfway through the course, near the end of the course, I'd see some Rios coming through. And I'd listen to these guys on the radio, and I'm going like, God, these guys are amazing. And I'd be going, man, I'm glad I'm already here, because this guy would take my seat. And actually, some of those guys, we did get them back as instructors. And of course, you know, we didn't tell them how great they were when they walked in. You know, it's like, no, you're just here because we needed you, you know. But some of these guys were incredible. And it's not only Rios. I mean, I'm talking about that. But, yeah, we had some pilots who were just, you know, fantastically talented fighter pilots of all three types: F4s, F14s, and F18s.
Brilliant. Okay, so you're at Top Gun. You're an instructor there. Tell us now about Top Gun the movie. You know, you get a call from Hollywood, and all of a sudden you're part of a Hollywood blockbuster. This now, you know, aviation movie history. How the heck did that come about?
Well, it started because of Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer. They were inspired by a magazine article that had photos taken by a former Top Gun instructor, Heater Heatley. And I put all this stuff in the second version of my, or the current version of my book. The soft cover has this bonus chapter that goes more into this background. But I tell it in the main story. So these two producers, they get inspired to make this movie. They go to Navy brass, they get permission, and then we at the squadron hear about it. And we heard about projects like this before. Sometimes they didn't happen. Sometimes they didn't turn into anything or whatever. And so I'm sitting there going like, yeah, whatever. Well, then they show up, and okay, these guys are showing up, and they've got a lot of people here, and they seem to be pretty serious about making a movie. And so I'm going, okay, maybe something's going to happen. Well, then they sent a script over to the Top Gun squadron. They sent a draft script, and we had to they asked us for comments. Well, they had misunderstood some terms. They had some storylines that we were just going like, okay, this is stupid. We cannot allow our names to be associated with this. And to their credit, they were receptive. I mean, when they asked us for our opinion, they wanted our answer. You know, they weren't just trying to make us feel good or just BSing us. So they worked with us quite well to work on the script. And meanwhile, the filming is going on other places around San Diego, like, you know, at aircraft carriers and other locations and stuff. And so we're hearing about filming. And so I'm sitting there going, well, this is actually happening, you know. So when they showed up, and I first really got a close exposure to them, they were a pretty impressive group. And I got to tell you, you know, as fighter pilots in Rios and as Top Gun instructors, we would have been the first ones to badmouth them as, you know, you guys are amateurs. You guys don't know what you're doing. I would do that. I would throw rocks at them if they deserved it, but they didn't. In my opinion, they earned our respect by being professional at their craft and by asking us for our input where we were the experts. So,
I mean, you guys had a fair bit of input into the script to make the dialogue seem authentic. So which lines are yours?
Well, the one single line that I actually said in the cockpit was, "Watch the mountains." Goose says that in the movie, and I said that to Jaws one time.
Fantastic.
But other things, you know, do some pilot S. I don't know what kind of language you guys use on your show here, but where Goose says, hey, do some pilot stuff, and then various other things, a lot of that came out of the Miramar community. People said that.
Yeah.
People really said that. Yes.
The other thing that comes out of your book as well is the kind of the aerial flying scenes and setting that up. I mean, you know, Clay Lacy in a Learjet and the way that the filmmaker's got special dispensation to get very close in, you know, and what was that like? You know, if you had these rules that the bubble there, and all of a sudden said, well, you know, wow, we're going to get closer than we've ever been here before, but you know,
hey, no one's been this close before.
Yeah, well, you know, fingers crossed.
Well, we started out, you know, we're talking about the rules of engagement and the head-on pass, and the training rules, not rules of engagement, but the training rules had a 500-foot bubble around airplanes, and so that's what we were used to. We're used to flying in opposition 500 feet from other airplanes in training. And so then we go out there, and 500 feet was way too far to be effective for this movie. So we started to work the distances in closer, and we started going, well, wait a minute. You know, we're not in a dynamic dogfight training environment, so we can reduce that distance. And so we reduce the distance, we film another pass, and the director goes, that's still not close enough. And I'm going like, well, that was close enough for me. So we did a quick, you know, debrief on the radio and planned it and said, okay, let's do it one more time closer. And we did another close pass, and it was a close pass. I mean, we had two F-14s against four F-5s, and we were all flying in between pretty tight, but it worked. And it really, I mean, it wasn't scary, because that would have been, nobody was that dumb, but it was exciting. Let's say that, you know.
Brilliant.
And nobody, you know, nobody wanted to get killed or break an airplane to film a movie. That'd be, you know, that'd be a bad reason to bend some metal.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to have one last question for me, and then I'm going to throw it to everybody else, because I can hear everybody else kind of straining to ask questions. So my question is you know, it obviously makes a lot of concessions for in realism for a movie audience, you know, and pilots love taking it apart. But what's your biggest pet peeve about a blooper that made it in that kind of makes you wince?
There's so many flaws that the biggest one that I think is not even particularly aviation related, but it's where Maverick says, on three, he goes, you know, okay, I'm going to do it on three. And he goes, 3, 2, 1. So it's like, wait a minute, it on one, you know. But oh yeah, there's a lot of flaws. But as I say in my book, I got that out of my system when I talked to the director, Tony Scott, and he goes, Dave, he goes, we're not making a documentary here. And you can't argue with the fact that it was it's an exciting, good movie, you know.
It's a brilliant movie. Yeah. It's a
And the F-14 and the F-5s, you know, we get 20, 22 minutes, whatever, of screen time. Okay, good. You know, be happy with that. So, you know, okay, here's something. Don't get me started. Okay, this is a slippery slope. One is the idea that these guys are flying around in formation in a dogfight. No. You know, that don't leave your wingman. That's dramatic and it's good for the screen, but what that really meant was we were in mutual support in an engagement. So it did not mean that you fly don't leave your wingman, or the wingman shouldn't leave. That doesn't mean you fly in formation. It means you're still in the engagement, ready to support the guy. That's probably a big blooper there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was dramatic the way they did it.
It makes a great movie. Anybody else? What other questions have we got for while we're on the whole thing anyway?
But I have one. This might be a duff question, because it might just be a straight no. Charles Heatley was a naval representative of the Constant Peg program with the MiGs. Were you ever given an exposure to the MiGs as part of your training or via Top Gun?
Next question. I will tell you that there's two great books about that program, and I am so glad that they came out, because I told my wife, I go, look at this, look at these books, aren't these great?
Steve Davis's book Red Eagles is fantastic, and that's the inspiration for that question.
Yeah, Gail Peck's book is good too.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take that as a yes.
Well, Bio, let's bring things around then to the book Top Gun Days, which is your story, and it sounds like there's another book imminent, so very excited about that. Great write-ups. It's quite interesting, actually, when I was doing a little bit of research, there was some very genuine responses to the book: honest, courageous, detail, unaffected, you know, comments like that. What made you I suppose turn to the pen and write that book?
Well, I was waiting and waiting, and nobody else was going to write my story, so I said, you know what, I'm gonna have to do this myself. So I'll tell you, I was shortly after I retired, I'm a defense contractor now, so I have a desk job, but I was driving home from work and I was thinking about writing a magazine article, and then after just a couple of minutes I go, no, you know what, I'm gonna write a book. And just, it's just something, the way I am, I mentioned it to my wife, and just once I thought of the idea, I said, I'm not giving up on this. And so I wrote the book. I had some very good encouragement. A departed dear friend, George Hall, who is a fantastic aviation photographer, he was the only person I told about it, besides my wife, when I was working on it. And he encouraged me. And that was very helpful. And then it was just kind of – then it was fun. I enjoyed writing it. I enjoyed reliving it, doing the research, and it was a fun project. And so then it was a challenge just getting it published, just the numbers. Anyone that's written a book and wanted to get published, it's the numbers. You know, there's a lot of competition. So that was an enjoyable challenge, and it was very rewarding to have it, to get it done. And I am – you know, this is a word that I hate to use, but it's from the heart. I'm gratified that it has been well received. And I do read, I've gotten, you know, one or two people have thrown a dart at it, and I go, well, either they missed the point, or, you know, it's not what they were looking for. Okay, that's fine. But you know, overwhelmingly positive reviews, and that has made me feel good.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation, and that's not to blow smoke. Genuinely, the response to the book has been very positive. Just to wrap things up then, Bio, in terms of your career with the Navy, I mentioned right at the beginning you did some work with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the U.S. 7th Fleet. What rank did you leave the Navy at?
Well, before I go too far, I thank you for your comments on the book. And then to talk about, to move on to answer your question, I retired as a commander, which is an O5 equivalent to a lieutenant colonel for the other U.S. services. And it just opens the door to something that I thought, it's like flying, it's like being in a squadron and being in the Navy. There's so much more to the experience that made it, you know, a fulfilling, a rewarding career. You know, working on the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, working on the U.S. 7th Fleet staff, the people that I met, the projects I worked on, and the things that I did, it's very rewarding, because it's challenging. You get challenged all the time. You're given great responsibility, and so I think all the military services are like this, and probably I expect any, you know, most careers as people advance, you learn, you get new challenges and things that you can contribute, show your expertise. And so long answer to a short question.
Well, we eagerly await the next book. It's been an absolute pleasure having you and Andy join us today on Extended. There's so much more to ask, but of course, for those who want to know a little bit more, they really should go to your website and read the book. So where can we find those links, Bio?
My website is www.topgunbio. That's just TopGunBio.com. And that's got links to places that you can buy the book. In terms of an international audience, hard to say. I have links to Amazon.com in the U.S. And then I'm on Facebook as Top Gun Days, the name of the book. So, you know, hopefully that'll get people started.
Okay, we'll put links to those in the show notes as well. And Andy, if you've still been graciously keeping up with us, just a reminder, where can we find out about the I Want One of Those F-14 Tomcat Facebook page?
If you're on Facebook, all you've got to do is just go to the search box, type in... Hang on, let's find it.
As he types it in. All right. Well, we'll put a link. We'll put a link to the page in the show notes. So, Tim, Gareth, if there's nothing else we want to ask Bio, we'll sign off.
I've got a final question. Bio, have you sent in your CV for Top Gun 2? this time it's drones.
I know. I know.
Working on top. No, I put mine in.
I think they got more current people and stuff like that. So, no, I'll just be in the audience for this one.
Right, Bio, thank you very much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You guys, I have enjoyed talking to you, and thanks for having me. And I'll be checking in on your website to keep tabs on what you're doing also. It's a great website. Thank you.
Well, wonderful.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Andy, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Andy. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, we'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can now find Extended on UK podcasters, Stitcher.com, and of course at iTunes as well. Please do leave us feedback on whatever platform you listen to us on, and many of our new listeners would have found us earlier if we'd have been better ranked, so please do leave us some feedback. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before you using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. I hope you've enjoyed this special episode on the F-14 Tomcat. We hope to bring you some more special episodes like this in future. But Tim, more importantly, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm RES Tim R on Twitter, and www.aerosociety.com on the big World Wide Web.
And Gareth?
You find Global Aviation Resource at globalaviationresource.com, and you'll find me at Pete Maverick Mitchell. Oh, no, that's not right, is it? It's Gareth _ Stringer on Twitter.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Is it cold there? Is it cold there still?
Hey, it's always cold. Chilly. It's always cold in comparison to where you're living, my friend.
I like the cold, to be honest. I like the cold and gray days. It doesn't bother me. So.
Hey, we'll do it. We'll do a swap one day.
Now, I have one more thing I have to share with you. Listening to you guys on the podcast, I developed pictures of you in my head.
Oh dear.
Don't worry. This is fine. But before I knew how you and Tim and Gareth looked, you and Tim look exactly like I pictured you.
Okay.
Exactly like I pictured you. In fact, you look younger than I pictured you.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
Sure. And Tim looks exactly like me. Now, Gareth, he doesn't. For some reason, and this is my brain being the brain that it is, but for some reason, I pictured Gareth looking like the actor Thomas Hayden Church. Do you know who that is?
No, but I'm sure Thomas, if you show me a picture, I will look Thomas, it up.
Thomas Hayden Church, he was in the movie Sideways. He was in the movie Spider-Man 3. He's got kind of like long hair. That, I don't know why, but that's the guy I pictured. And I saw his photo, Gareth's photo, and he doesn't look like that. But, you know, that's not really a knock against him at all. It's just a comment I wanted to make to you.
Right. I'm desperately looking him up. Thomas Hayden Church. I've got to see this now.
Sure. But as okay. I said, you and Tim look exactly like a
Right. Okay. Yes, I know who you're talking about now. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Interesting.
I wanted to throw that in there. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Sure. As you say over there, I'm chuffed to bits.
But on the whole,
like being briefed for a fast jet trip, Pete.
Sure. Yeah, this is the best we've ever done, Bio and Andy. I can assure you. Normally, our guests come onto the call and.
I'll tell you what, you guys' accents are going to kill me, so I'm sure.
F-22 fitters that fired on the F-14 Tomcats.
SU-22 fitters.
There you go, there's another outtake. I'll start that again. Now,
I think that would be quite an interesting engagement if the Libyans had F-22s.
Yeah. I know they're trying to say we can go forward in time, but that's going a bit forward in time too much.
That's another question for Bio. The final countdown.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Zeros versus F-14s.
They nearly crashed a Tomcat doing that, you know?
You guys don't have the clearance to hear that.
I'm not sure we could ever actually reach a point where there's no more questions, but hey, hi.
I've got to go start the grill because I'm grilling dinner.
No worries.
Tonight. we'll be round in 10 minutes then.
Come on over.
Yep, get the volleyball net set up.
I wish I could unsee that. Thank you.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.